Sarum, dear listeners, and welcome once again to Vahini Satsang. I'm Team Radio Sai's Bishu, and along with me, as always, is Sai Prakash. As we go on deliberating on the 17th chapter of Prema Vahini, if you are referring to the original Telugu of Bhagavan, it is chapter 5 in Prema Vahini. And this segment, if you are listening to chapter 17 and the discussion we have been having the last few weeks, it is completely focused on Sanatana Dharma. And the last time we discussed the sixth segment of chapter 17. So let's move on now. We will listen to the next segment. There are three more segments. It is a pretty long chapter, very significant one. So let's listen to 17.7. Now these segments are what we have done. We have tried to break the chapters into sizable segments which would be useful for our discussion. So, I mean, this you can do it in any way that you like, but just for ease of sharing of thoughts, this is a categorization that we have done. So let's move on to segment 17.7. Let's listen to it and then we'll pray to Bhagwan to guide our thoughts.
Piruguta విరుగుట కొరకే అన్నట్టు ఇప్పటి అశాంతి వాతావరణం విరుగుటకే కాని పెరుగుటకు కాదు. లేకున్నా ఆది నుంచి ఎంతో పవిత్రమైన పద్ధతులతో, భావనలతో, సహనంతో, పేరు ప్రఖ్యాతులతో, వేదశాస్త్ర ఉపనిషత్తులను ఉగ్గుపాలతో పెరిగి దేశభ్రష్టులైన మానవులను ఆదరించి అట్టివారికి అండనొసగి సమంజస ప్రేమలు పంచిపెట్టిన భారతీయులు నేడు చూడు. భారత సోదరులనే తూలనాడుతూ ఒకరిపై ఒకరు అధికారులు కాగోరి ఒకరి క్షేమమును ఒకరు ఓర్వలేక అసూయాపరులై పదవీ ప్రతిష్టలకు పాల్పడి అహంకారపరులై తమ భారత సోదరులనే వంచుచూ అభివృద్ధి కోరువారిని అణగద్రొక్కుచూ తమ స్వార్థమును పొందగోరి హిందువులలో ఎన్నడూ కని విని ఎరుగని దుర్గుణములను అభివృద్ధిపరచుకుని అనాచారమాచరించుచూ పాపభీతి దైవప్రీతి వినయ భయ విశ్వాసములు లేక ఇంతటి అశాంతికి గురియై శాంతికి దూరముగుట భారతీయులకు తలవంపు కదా.
దే సే అన్రిస్ట్రెయిన్డ్ గ్రోత్ విల్ సూన్ సీ ఇట్స్ డౌన్ఫాల్. సిమిలర్లీ ద ప్రెసెంట్ డే రెస్ట్లెస్నెస్ విల్ నాట్ ఎక్స్పాండ్ ఇన్డెఫినెట్లీ, ఇట్ విల్ ఓన్లీ సీ ఇట్స్ ఎండ్. ఫ్రమ్ ద బిగినింగ్ ద భారతీయర్స్ గ్రూ అప్ ఇన్ రైచియస్ వేస్ విత్ ప్యూర్ ఫీలింగ్స్ for bearance, good name and reputation, and were nourished by the milk of Vedas, Shastras and Upanishads. They welcomed and cared for even races who were driven out of their own country and treated them with equal love. Such Bharatiyas are today, for the sake of power and pelf, accusing each other, are unable to stomach the welfare of their own brethren due to jealousy, and are hankering after authority and position. Because of selfishness, they are deceiving their own countrymen, suppressing those who are desirous of progress, and are always focused on their own selfish ends. Also, hitherto, unheard of evil traits in Hindu people are increasing. People are engaging in indecorous behaviors and have no regard for fear of sin, love for God, humility, faith and reverence. They are thus subjected to restlessness and are far removed from peace. This degradation in Bharatiyas is indeed a matter of shame.
So that is what Bhagwan is saying in this segment. We are in the last part of chapter 17. There are two more segments to go. But here Bhagwan begins by saying unrestrained growth will soon see its downfall. You know, when I hear, Sai Prakash, this unrestrained growth,
yes,
the word that comes to my mind is cancer.
Oh, okay.
No, because okay, that's what happens in cancer, isn't it?
Absolutely.
The yeah, cells in the body, somehow yeah, they go haywire and there is a tumor happens because there is unrestrained growth.
The word which came to my mind was capitalism.
Yeah. I mean, cancer in the body, that is cancer in society.
Society. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, it's unrestrained growth. Absolutely.
Yes. Yes. And of a particular thing at the cost of the others.
Right. Right.
Basically. And, you know, when you think about cancer, as I was saying, you know, cancer of the body is what came to my mind. But when I think about cancer in society, that's what Swami is referring to here, the restlessness in society.
Right.
And at the mental level, at the psychological level, what is the cancer? Cancer, I feel, is the unrestrained growth of ego.
Okay.
Unrestrained growth of ego. Mm. That is what, mm. I mean, when you hear about Bhagwan's discourses, mm. so, I mean, Swami has told, what is Ravana? Ravana is basically unrestrained growth of kama. Mm. What is Duryodhana? Unrestrained growth of lobha.
Based on selfishness.
Based on selfishness.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the words which Swami has given a lot of importance in several of his discourses is kshama. Forbearance.
Mm.
And in that beautiful poem of Khanda Khandantara, where Swami, yes, sings about the glory of
India
and Indian culture, he says there is goodness in the soil.
Yes.
There is goodness. Manchitanamu is there,
yes,
in the soil.
Mm.
And he says shama, forbearance, is something very, very, in fact, Swami says shama satyam, kshama dharmam,
yes,
kshama shanti. I think he has given several discourses just on the aspect,
yes,
of kshama,
mm,
or forbearance.
Mm.
And I was just thinking, you know, maybe we could try to understand why kshama or forbearance is very important.
Hmm.
Because, you know, in a situation, suppose, for example, you're working in an IT firm or you're working in any company, is it your duty to just stay silent and accept everything that is being heaped upon you? Or do you have, is it your duty to stand up and then, you know, voice your opinion and fight for your rights?
Hmm. Well, someone asked me some time back, you know, what is forbearance? And I wanted to play with those words.
Hmm.
And I said, when you can bear it for him.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. Yeah.
You know, you bear it for, not for the other person.
Mm.
You bear it for him, for the capital H. You know, you do it for God.
Mm.
You bear it for God.
True.
If you can bear it for him, then that is perfect.
You know, that's so true. And another thing which comes to mind, you know, there are forbearance. If I look at it, two streams of thought come to my mind. So one is like, exactly like you said,
yes,
you know, offer everything,
yes,
for his sake.
Yes.
But then again, the thought, why should I do it? Why should I do it? And why don't I have the right to, you know, fight for this? The second stream of thought, the second perspective, I think, is don't give too much importance to the worldly happenings.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a sense,
yes,
you start feeling, okay, this has happened. Okay, I accept it and go along. So when your mind is, you know, set on a spiritual goal, I think automatically, in a sense, these frills and peripherals, of course, you need basic necessities of life. You need food, you need shelter, you need money to live, you need all these things. But then you're not overly obsessed by them.
Yes. And what I would like to think is, it is not as if you will not get these basic needs or the comforts or,
right,
the so-called, you know, whatever you need to lead a happy, comfortable life.
Mm-hmm.
If you bear it for him,
mm,
with that faith, all this will automatically happen.
Absolutely.
I mean, we feel that our strength lies in being aggressive. Our strength lies in doing that. But actually, our strength lies in trying to absorb it,
mm-hmm,
and making that, you know, strengthening ourselves,
mm-hmm,
because people will see this silent strength in us, you know, that kind of outward strength. There's so many people have it,
mm-hmm,
but very few people have this silent strength, you know, the strength drawn from inner reserves. And yeah, I think that is more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
That probably will take little time,
mm-hmm,
but I think once people know that, once people see that, then the amount of power you get, the amount of inner confidence you get, and as well as the confidence that you are able to give to people around you,
mm,
I think that is much more.
In fact, you know, slightly deviating.
Yes.
we know that story of, when Swami was in Karnam Subbamma's house.
Yes.
As a very young boy who had just declared that I am the avatar.
Yes.
And there was this great, so-called great yogi who was coming to Puttaparthi, and people thought that he will expose Swami, this small kid, in a second. Mm. And all the more great about him is he was completely Digambara.
Yes.
So he had no, absolutely no clothes on. And that is the sign of greatest renunciation and all that.
Mm.
And so the people who were carrying him had to have a lot of forbearance because they were bearing him on a palanquin, you know, on a palanquin, on a palanquin. And they brought him.
Yes.
And they told, they called out to Swami, who was a young boy then, and said, come out and meet this great yogi. And Swami just turned around, looked at a small piece of towel and said, first tell him to cover himself.
Cover himself, yeah.
So, you know, first tell him to cover himself. And the sannyasi was totally aghast. He was like taken aback. And then Swami called him and said, stop this tamasha and this show.
Yes.
The main reason why you are doing this is you are not having faith and confidence that God who has created you will protect you. So when you said forbearance, bear it for him.
Yes.
Like really, Swami said, you go. At that time Swami told him, you go to the farthest corner of any forest. You go to the, highest
deepest
piece of
jungles.
Yeah, jungles. Well. Anywhere you go.
Yes.
To the town, to the city, anywhere you go, have faith that God will protect you. And since you cannot, you want to lead a life with forbearance for him. You want to lead your life for him. But then you're giving so much trouble to everybody else. So.
Yeah. In fact, you know, when you were mentioning about how we should, know about the temporariness of everything around. I mean, that's what, of course, gives you, when once you know that the only permanent thing in the world is that imprint of pure love, everything else just changes. Then, you know, I mean, only when that is the goal can you take life, give only that much importance to life as it deserves. And, yes.
No, actually, that's so true, because our culture, our traditions, everything is based on that, that eternal aspect.
Moksha. Dharma, artha, kama, moksha.
And it's based on a spiritual base. It's based on the truth.
Yes.
And, you know, in fact, again, taking a small digression, there is that beautiful interview I heard of Yehudi Mehunin, who was an excellent violin player. And Pandit Ravi Shankar and Yehudi Mehunin, they did a lot of albums as Jugalbandi.
Okay.
So East meets West. And in one of the interviews, he says, I have never been to India, but he's so much in love with Indian music. And he says, whoever you are, whichever part of the world you are, whatever your genre of music is, ultimately it comes back to India.
Wow.
Ultimately it is Indian. We all are Indian at heart, because that is the ultimate.
Yes.
And I was so moved when I heard that. He says, yeah, these are all come out from, because that is based on the eternal.
Yes. Yes.
And
everything merges into the eternal.
Everything merges. And so here, people must have thought we are fools. Indians are, you know, somebody comes and raids us, we accept. Yes. Somebody comes and rules us, we accept.
Yes.
Somebody comes and does something, we say, okay.
Yes.
Life goes on.
Yes.
Because sometimes I feel we really don't take life so seriously.
So seriously.
And it's no excuse for not taking something seriously in your life.
Yes.
And if we are really guided on the right path of what our culture stands for, that, you know, a Nivritti Marga.
Yes.
The Nivritti Marga, which is a spiritual of pursuit, spiritual pursuit.
Yes.
I think that is what has to come into focus very soon.
In fact, you know, as we are talking about this, and I'm reminded of Madalasa. You remember Queen Madalasa?
Yes, Swami used
Swami
to,
used
say
to
the
mention
story
in the discourses. You know, here also, as where Bhagwan is saying that, you know, in Bharatiyas, everyone was nourished by the milk of Vedas, Shastras and Upanishads. And I was reminded of that. You know, because Madhalasa tried to do that to her...
To her children.
To her children.
Yes.
And in fact, Swami says how when she put her kids on the cradle, she used to sing this lullaby saying, you know, placing you in the cradle of Omkara, on the bed of the great saying, Tattvamasi. Swinging to the music of awareness, dear child, may the gods lull you to sleep. The four Vedas are the four chains of the cradle. May your heart be filled with the nine forms of devotion. I mean, this is how she raised her children. Of course, in there are so many versions of this story. And they say that one other lullaby that she used to sing is Suddhosi, Buddhosi, Niranjanosi, Samsara Maya, Parivaptosi.
My God.
Samsara Swapnam, Tyaja, Mohanidram, Madalasopam, Uvachaputram. Madalasopam, Uvasaputram. And this is what Madalasa used to say that, you know, oh child, you are that eternal one. You are the Niranjana. You are the most purest one. You are just the absolute super consciousness in this little form. And you know, just like when you wake up into Jnana, then, you know, you realize that everything else is Maya. The world is Maya only when you wake up into Jnana. It's same as when you wake up from sleep, then you know that it was all a dream. So world is a dream. You are experiencing everything only because you have not woken up to the knowledge of wisdom. I mean, this is how she raised her kids. In fact, the story goes that, you know, she was married to King Ritadhwaja. So they have in due course four children, Vikranta, Subahu, Shatrumardana, and the last one is called Alarka.
Okay.
And so the Vikranta means one who possesses great valor and courage. Subahu is one who is powerful and with beautiful hands and shoulders. Shatrumardana is one who conquers the enemies. But when they married, there was a pact between them where Madalasa says that, I will educate my children. I should have the complete freedom.
No questions asked
about educating the children. And the king, who desperately wanted to have her as his wife, had to agree. And so, when the first son was born, you know, she trained this son with all these tenets of the Vedas, and the son was so filled with vairagya that, you know, he didn't want to take up kingdom and, you know, become a prince, and he went to the forest. The same thing happened with Subahu also.
Oh, okay.
When it came to Shatrumardana, now the king thought, you know, he is the one who is going to now become the king and conquer my enemies, but the way the mother trained Shatrumardana, he realized that what is the outside enemy? There are no enemies outside. All the enemies are inside. So Shatrumardana also...
the vanquisher of enemies.
Yeah.
He looked within.
So he also went to the forest. And then came the fourth son. And at that point in time, one story goes that, you know, the king was now very perturbed. He said, you know, three sons we had and you have sent everyone to the forest. You know, what is happening? And Madalasa says, see, you are breaking the promise. This is a promise we made that I will tutor the children. And now the king is helpless. And then when she stopped from educating the children, that is when she gets very... disturbed, and she goes to the forest and she says that she merges into Ganga. She goes into Ganga. And so the son that is left is Alarka. So Alarka becomes king, and Alarka is now trained by the king.
Okay.
And you know, in all ways of the world, and he picks up all the wicked traits and everything. The king, with a vengeance, he teaches him everything that that should not be taught to a child, perhaps. And so Alarka becomes the king. But once he becomes the king, the neighboring kingdoms, they attack and they defeat Alarka.
Okay.
And Alarka has to now leave the kingdom. He's forcibly asked to leave the kingdom. And and he's utterly dejected. So, you know, then he suddenly remembers that his mother, on the eve of her departure, had given him a ring.
Okay.
And advised him to break it open if ever he found himself in great danger. He said, then you will find the good advice. Whatever his advice is there in this ring, that will help you.
Okay.
At that point in time. So now Alarka opened. This is the time. So he opens that ring, and inside that he finds a small piece of paper on which there are many instructions written. One was, give up all sorts of company. If you are unable to do that, then keep the company of only the good. Give up all sorts of desires. If you are unable to do that, then cherish only one desire, the desire for salvation.
Wow. Amazing.
And then Alarka gives up everything. And he goes out in search of this ultimate goal of life. And that is when this quest brings him to a place called Vakreshwar. This is in the current West Bengal. And that is where he meets sage Ashtavakra.
Okay.
And Ashtavakra was doing penance. And when he converses with Ashtavakra, Ashtavakra starts tutoring him.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that is part of the Raja Yoga, what evolved later on as Ashtavakra Samhita. They advise the conversation that happens between Alarka and Ashtavakra. And soon Alarka, you know, becomes a great yogi. I mean, all that is perhaps that was there in inside just
in
came
the genes.
Out. Yeah, in the genes. And he becomes a great yogi. And his reputation as a yogi and a saint spreads far and wide. And when this happens, that king who had conquered him, he comes back to him.
Okay.
And he says, you know, please take back your kingdom.
Wow.
Take back.
Mm.
And, but Alarka
has given up the...
Yeah, Alarka says, no. I am now busy to spread this gospel. I want to spread this gospel of Dharma in the world. I want to only serve society in this capacity. You can look after the affairs of the royal administration. See, I feel this story is very significant for so many reasons. One is, it shows, as Swami says, you know, mothers in the current times, Swami says, you know, they teach their children, start with Baba, black sheep, ding dong bell,
yeah,
and all that,
yeah,
which make no sense. And Swami says, how in the earlier times you have to start with Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namo Narayana. I mean, that's what is the Prahlada story, isn't it? Even before Prahlada was born, Om Namo Narayana is what was resonating in him. And so in Indian culture, this is what people, everyone was nourished with these values, you know, right from the time they started breathing, the soul started breathing. And, you know, as you are asking, you know, if you follow this path, you lose everything. But as we see, you'll get back everything.
True.
After that, you become a greater king, actually. I mean, if you wanted, you could have still become a king. But you are actually much greater than a Maharaja now, because, you know, Maharajas are coming and falling at your feet, actually.
Correct. Yeah, but... also, there's that beautiful example of King Janaka, Swami says, how he led perfectly the ways of the world. At the same time, he, you know, when you're talking about Madalasa and all this whole thing, the whole idea of how, you know, we grew up here in Swami's presence, that comes to mind, because suddenly, you know, Swami relentlessly, whether we understood anything or not, whether we, how many discourses we were fast asleep, and, you know, he relentlessly gave us that message, which it just sticks. I mean, body is like a water bubble, mind is like a mad monkey. Don't follow the body, don't follow the mind, follow your conscience. So this was like, you know, like breathing in and breathing out for us. Love all, serve all. I mean, when I, you know, as a part of the training, when I went to Delhi, I realized how much we have been pampered. How much we have been pampered, really. Only when you see people who are actually under that so-called stress, you know, quote-unquote stress for a small thing.
Yes.
Somebody passed a comment, oh, they have to go and smoke. three cigarettes because they are under a lot of stress. And youngsters who are absolutely, you know, torn apart by this word called stress. And so it's amazing because as children you really accept what is being told to you. And so Swami has been telling this, so somewhere it's there.
It is there.
Deep within.
I think that's why Swami started this Balvikas movement. And one thing, you know, the same thought that was going on also in my mind was, is, you know, when these things probably, it will take you lifetime or lifetimes to actually understand these.
Correct.
But, you know, but if it is there, it will come. It will sprout from your inner being at the right moment. And see, just like even now also, we are still trying to understand these things.
Correct. Educare, that's what Swami says.
Educare. I mean, one thing is to understand and later on make it a part of your life. That definitely needs so much of practice and so much of relentless effort. Mm. But that is what Indian culture is all about, you know, that's what Swami is saying. And then, of course, I was also reminded of Abhimanyu, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when you think about Abhimanyu's role in Mahabharata, and the Chakravyuha is staged and by Drona, and all the stalwarts from the Kaurava army are there, I think, including Bhishma. And there is a call to go to the battlefield because there is no one else. And when Abhimanyu hears the call, he wants to go, and actually Abhimanyu's mother Subhadra, Subhadra is very perturbed. Subhadra says, how will you go, you know, you are still so young and you probably don't know how to deal with it, your father is not there, your uncles are not there, you know, your wife is pregnant, do you think you should go? But Abhimanyu says, mother, what is important, what is my duty, do you want to be known as the mother of a coward? You know, my dharma, good name, as Swami says here, you know.
Manchitanam.
Good name. Good name is what is most important. You know, I'm thinking, how many will think, oh no, yaar, I can't go, my wife is pregnant. Mm. Oh no, I can't go, yaar, my father is not there. Mm. Oh no, yaar, my uncle is not there. You know, my mother also, you'll take, even you'll say, no, my mother is telling I will not go. You know, but here was Abhimanyu, who said, no, this is what I have to do, because this is what is my duty now, and this is the Kshatriya dharma, and that's how, and I think he has become immortal, he has become eternal and immortal because of that. This is, I felt, you know, this is what Bhagavan is saying, you have to earn. Swami used to say that, you know, your birthday is not when you are born, your birthday is when you earn a good name. If your parents hear that, you know, oh, he's your child, he's so good. That good
fact,
name.
Absolutely. In fact, Mahabharata has so many lessons, and Swami often quotes that example of when the Upapandavas were killed.
Yes.
By Ashwatthama.
Yes.
So when the Upapandavas were killed, and Arjuna is all ready to go and you know, attack, then Draupadi stops.
Yes, yes.
Draupadi, who is, you know, in the peak of sorrow at that time.
Yes.
When, you know, the entire heir to the dynasty is gone.
Yes.
Is totally destroyed. And she says, if we also behave like him, then what's the difference?
Yes.
That level of forbearance at that, you know, at the height of that distress and that state of is something most amazing. Swami used to often quote with a nice flourishing poem. Swami used to give that.
And hail Draupadi. I mean, we had that kind of mothers.
Correct.
I mean, what is Indian culture without all these virtuous mothers?
Correct.
Yeah. And in fact, here, you know, Bhagavan goes on to say how in Indian culture, you know, we welcomed and cared for even races who were driven out of their own country. And we treated them with equal love. I think that is so much. And I mean, when you read about Indian civilization, I mean, as everyone knows, and we mentioned this before also, how India has never ever had an occasion where it has staged a war. It is never a country where it wanted to occupy another country. And it was a country which continuously assimilated whoever came with open arms. In fact, a classic case which is always often quoted is the Parsi community in India, isn't it? I mean, how in some time, I think this happened in BC, actually, mm-hmm. when, you know, the Sasanian Empire, mm-hmm. which was following Zoroastrianism. Zoroastrianism is the one of the oldest religions,
mm-hmm.
And it fell to Arab Muslims. You know, Muslims took over that mm-hmm. kingdom, and now this group of Zoroastrians, they were looking for refuge. And so that is how they come to the western shores of India.
Okay.
And there is that famous story that happened in the 16th century of, you know, how these early Zoroastrian settlers, they came to the shores of Sanjan. And they presented, the ruler of that region in India was Jadi Rana.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they come there, this ruler sends to them a glass full of milk.
Okay.
And so it was a metaphor
mm.
conveying that, you know, my glass is full. You know, I want to take you, but there is no space,
mm.
no space for the newcomers.
Mm.
And it is then that the Zoroastrians also responded so beautifully.
Mm.
They added spoonfuls of sugar into that milk and they sent it back.
Amazing.
And they said, you know, they will add sweetness and nothing is going to overflow. Milk is not going to overflow.
Mm.
And you know, so the Jadi Rana was so happy that, you know, he welcomed this community. And, you know, that is how the Parsi community found a home in India. And this community, you know, even though it forms a very, very tiny section mm. of Indian population, it's perhaps 0.06%, mm. 0.6% of Indian population, but it is this community which has done yeoman service. I mean, you see the number of legendary figures
right.
that this community has gifted India with, starting from, you know, Dadabhai Naroji, from the freedom fighters to Jamshedji Tata. I mean,
mm.
The whole Tata group of companies and the amount of philanthropy that this group does. Homi Bhabha, the nuclear physicist. You have Fali Nariman, who is the famous advocate. And they have been there in all the important places. I mean, in the growth of India, in the governance of India,
mm-hmm.
the first cotton mill, the first steel plant, the first Institute of Fundamental Research.
They were really sugar to the community.
Really, really, mm. absolutely. In fact, you know, I'm also reminded of Mr. Fani Banda.
Yes.
No, added,
Dr. Fani Banda.
Dr. Fani Banda.
Yeah.
Right, you know, they added so much sweetness.
In fact, we should mention here that with so much of love and devotion,
yes.
they have done a lot of films.
Yes.
They have shot a lot of films when Swami was, and Swami graciously gave permission,
mm-hmm.
and by Swami's grace, we have got all that films, and it's preserved well in the archives.
Yes,
I mean, if we want to really relive some of those earlier years, these invaluable films capture the, you know, yes. moments of those years. And soon we will start reliving those years. By
I mean, what is our Satyasai archives without Dr. Fani Banda's contribution?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes.
So, it's really amazing.
It's really. So, you know, when I was thinking about this Parsi community, and mm. you know that Dr. Fani Banda, as I mentioned, came to mind,
mm.
and in the same way, it's so interesting that what also came to mind is the other Indian Maharaja who was blessed again by Bhagwan directly.
Correct.
And immensely.
Yes.
And again, who has done yeoman contribution to the Satyasai mission.
Mm.
And in fact, the Maharani mm. was one of the founding members, sort of mm-hmm. the members of the Sri Satyasai Central Trust when Swami founded in 1972. The Rajmata of Navanagar
yes.
was one of the trustees. And later yes. on, she became one of the trustees of the university, became one of the council members of the Sri Satyasai World Organization, International Organization. And she was one of the founding pillars
right.
of the Satyasai mission.
Mm.
And so why I'm mentioning about him is here was another great king of mm. India who provided home
correct
to refugees
yes
to Polish refugees
correct.
And it is said, in fact, when I was reading their life, how they came to Bhagwan, and it's a very beautiful story. But one thing, when Swami, he comes to Parthi for the first time, Digvijay Singh Ji of Navanagar, Swami tells him that you have been a very good king.
Wow.
Swami says, and my connection with you, Swami says, goes back to so many years.
Wow.
Swami says, my connection is very old with you. And at that point in time, you know, he was also the person who had taken deep interest in the reconstruction of the Somnath temple. And of course, the whole story goes how Swami, he asked,
visited
Swami, and you know, Swami personally visited, after he built the Dwar. And of course, Swami gives him the darshan of Somnath and Dwarkadhish. Even though Swami did not, when he asked for eyes, you know, there's a big story. I narrated this morning in Outside Inside, Deep Inside.
Okay.
And let me just mention one very beautiful thing, you know, when he asks for this vision. Because at that point in time, he was losing eyesight. And Swami said, I know why you want eyes. You want to have darshan of Somnath ji and Dwarkadish. Swami said, for that, you don't need outer vision. You, what you need for that, I will give you. And I will definitely do it, Swami says. Actually. And that's what happens in the final moments of his life. When in the early morning hours, in February 1966, and when he's feeling uncomfortable and all that, and then he sits up on the chair, and Maharani asks him to lie down, but he says, no, I'm comfortable. And there is so much peace on his face. And it was as if, you know, he was in some other world. And the Maharani checks his pulse, and there's no pulse. So immediately she summons the doctors. The doctors come, and the doctors say that he has suffered a massive heart attack. There is no pulse. But there was something very strange about him. Even though there was no pulse and there was no blood pressure, but there was something on the upper part of her chest which was moving. They could see that there was something glowing there. It was very alive. And there was so much serenity. It was as if a superpower was just keeping him. The soul was still there, probably waiting for that moment. And he was in that state for quite some time. And then after on, and then later on, after that, she told the queen, you have been a very good woman, and God will look after you and all that, he says. And then he leaves finally. And then Swami's telegram comes. And Swami says that I gave him the darshan of Somnath and Dwarkadish, what he wanted in those final moments. Swami gave him that darshan. Anyway, but what I want to tell you is, you know, when Swami mentioned that you have been a very good king, you know, one instance at least we have in recorded history, which we came to know of it some time back. What happened is during the years preceding the World War II, so there were this huge number of Polish people, Poles, who were taken away by the Red Army to work in the Soviet Union labor camps.
Yes.
And so they were working in remote parts of Northeast USSR and Siberia. And when Hitler's army invaded Soviet Union in 1941, then USSR announced a general amnesty leading to the release of all these Polish exiles.
Okay.
From the labor camps. Because what they thought is probably all these people will form a army unit, a Polish army unit, to help them fight the German army, because the German army was advancing USSR. But what actually happened was all these people, they tried to escape. So all these refugees, because they were emaciated and they were undergoing a lot of, they were almost like living in concentration camps. So they wanted to escape. So from this cold parts of Soviet Union, they tried to come down to the, you know, warmer regions of Central Asia. So it was a very long, arduous journey stretched over hundreds of kilometers. And it was really a test of human endurance for them. And many perhaps didn't survive it also. Many lost their lives on the way because of the temperature, extreme temperature, hunger, malnutrition, dehydration. And so that journey stretched across many lands and many transit points. So they come to Ashgabat in Turkmenistan. They come to Tehran in Iran, Afghanistan. They come to Karachi. So at every each of these transit points, you know, they were seeking shelter, you know, but no one allowed them to disembark from their ships. And finally, when the ship docked in Mumbai, the British governor then also did not allow them entry. But Maharaja Digvijay Singh Ji, you know, Nawanagar, when he heard of the plight of the refugees, he said, no, we have to help them. And he pressurized the British government to allow the refugees to disembark. And but the British was not willing. So finally, when the British did not allow them to land in Mumbai, he got the ship and he docked the ship at Rosi Airport in his province, in Saurashtra.
Okay.
So that is how the story of Little Poland in India started. And as soon as these people disembarked, the Maharaja warmly welcomed everyone and he said, do not consider yourself as orphans. You are all now Navanagris.
My God.
I am your Bapu. You know, everyone calls me here Bapu, father. I am the people. I am the father of this people of Navanagar. And I am your Bapu too. That is what he said. And he immediately set up 10 accommodations for them. And in fact, in a place which was 25 kilometers away from the capital city of Jamnagar, he set up a camp. It was called Balachadi Camp. And then even for this, the British was objecting. And you know, how can you take foreign refugees? So the Maharaja went to the extent of saying the British that all these people are my family. I have adopted them. If you want, I will give adoption certificates.
My God.
That was the extent to which he was determined to help these people. And the Maharaja also was the Chancellor of the Council of Princes and the member of the Imperial War Cabinet in British India. So he knew the officials of the Polish government, which was in exile, you know, in exile that operated from London. So because of all these connections, he was also able to get support of the, you know, rulers of Patiala and Baroda, you know, the neighboring kingdoms. And he set up more camps. And then he also ensured that, you know, these refugees are not only provided accommodation, he built schools for them. He provided medical facilities, opportunities for them to have, you know, these common halls. And he got special cooks for them from Goa because they were, you know, some of them were not liking the local food.
My goodness, and what care.
And then, you know, and the interesting thing, imagine who helped the Maharaja apart from the local kingdoms, the Tatas, the Parsi community, whom India had given shelter, the Tatas. And a few other like-minded people, they raised over 600,000, 6 lakh of rupees. Imagine, we are talking about 1942. That's a huge sum. The Tatas raised this amount for this first batch of 500 refugees. And then they set up more camps in Kolhapur, in Mumbai and all that. And then, you know, Digvijay Singh Ji coordinated with the Polish government and... He started giving them education in Polish language. He arranged that, you know, the children get proper education. He also arranged for Catholic priests for their religious rites and everything. In fact, one of the survivors of, you know, one of the Polish survivors, he says that when we arrived at the camp, the Maharaja gave a party which, you know, in that party they didn't know what to eat. Because they were so hungry. You know, it was such a lavish party. And when some of them, you know, said that, you know, okay, we don't like this vegetable or we don't like that vegetable. Then, you know, after that he arranged for special cooks for them. So between 1942 and 1948, 20,000 refugees stayed and, you know, transited through that undivided India during that period of, you know, 6 months to 6 years. And so after the war ended and, you know, the Poland, the recognition of Poland government happened by Great Britain, then all these refugees were asked to return to Poland. And of course, many went to different countries, to UK and US and Australia, and some, of course, returned to Poland. And even till this day, they say that many of the survivors, you know, who are there in Poland, they say that if not for the Maharaja, we would have been in trouble. We would have been in trouble. He says, I still don't understand that in spite of being such a true patriotic Polish, one part of my soul still misses India. One of the survivors says, Because, you know, the way he made us feel at home in Amazing. India, the Maharaja. Mm. And, of course, the interesting thing also is, because of this gesture of the Maharaja, many others also opened their hearts to similar war refugees in other parts of the world. They took inspiration from the Maharaja. If Maharaja could do that, you know, especially during the World War II time, there are so many people who needed help. And he was sort of a torchbearer. No, he led the way. And there is this popular school in Warsaw, in Poland. It's called Bednarska High School. And in June 99, you know, they conducted a referendum. And overwhelmingly, everyone voted. And they passed this referendum to declare Maharaja Digvijay Singh Ji as the patron saint of the school.
Beautiful, beautiful.
In fact, they say that if you go to this school, you will find that inside it is all Indian classical designs, Indian rangolis, you know, Indian handicrafts, Indian paintings, and Indian gods and goddesses. It is like, just like how he created a little Poland for them, they have created a little India.
How
in Poland. And the school is run by Friends of India Education Foundation. And what this foundation also does, in this school now, they provide free education to refugees from other countries, from Vietnam, from Sri Lanka, from Bangladesh. They do that service now. And in 2013, the government of Poland inaugurated what is called the Good Maharaja Square in Warsaw.
Okay.
And the other also very heartening news is how Poland recently honored Maharaja Digvijay Singh Ji posthumously by presenting the Commander's Cross of the Order of the Merit of the Polish Republic. So it is basically for contributing to good relations between Poland and other countries. You give to very, very esteemed citizens who have contributed to Poland. So, I mean, I was just reminded of this, you know, when Bhagwan says that India has been that land which gave shelter and which welcomed and cared for anyone, for races who were even driven out of their own country.
But then the next paragraph, Swami says, but such Bharatiyas are today being driven by sake of power and pelf and accusing each other, are unable to stomach the welfare of their fellow brethren due to jealousy and are hankering after authority and position.
Yes. This is, I mean, that is the sad part.
That is the sad part. We had the glorious examples of Bharatiyas who followed the Indian scriptures and Vedas. Yes. And he says, where is all that going? And, you know, if you look at it, it's also a large case of imitation. So we are trying to imitate the West.
Yes.
And that comes about in, you know, several ways. Like, you know, the traditional... if you go to many traditional families, they have their own traditional beliefs and they have a reason why a festival is celebrated and why they do it in a particular way. And then the next generation is not very interested about that because they are more into Western influence. The Western influence, I mean, Western influence is a very broad term, but if they want to follow a Christian way of life, that is different.
Yes.
But then they want to follow a way of life which has no,
no.
Kind of binding on them.
Yes.
So possibly freedom of some sort is something what the youngsters... So
basically, it's just convenience.
Yeah, it's convenience. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's absolutely convenience.
Yeah. I mean, of course, these days people are very smart. If you ask them to do this or go to temple, they'll tell no, God is everywhere. Why should you know, but they won't have, but they will have 2 hours to watch a movie, but not 2 minutes to go to the, you know, altar and sit and do a prayer. Yeah. And, you know, when you're talking about these, you know, values not being communicated to the coming generations, I remember having this conversation with Mr. Swaminathan Gurumurthy.
Okay.
You know, one of India's thinkers, you know, great thinkers. So when I mentioned to him this, he said that this is not the mistake of the current generation.
Okay.
He said this is the mistake of the generation prior to that. Because he says, you know, we have not been able to convincingly communicate to this generation why a particular thing has to be done. So when, because this is a generation which asks questions, and when they don't find answers, which satiate their curiosity, you know, then they feel, you know, even you don't know what you're doing, so why are you asking me to do?
In fact, in a different light, sometimes you just see that that's what is happening with the Sai organization as well.
Yes.
Like, in many places, there is a growing anxiety as to how to bring youngsters back to the Sai organization, how to make them as vibrant as they were when Swami was physically present. Maybe, I'm sure there are many centers in the world where there are still many youngsters. I'm not saying no. But then, I don't think the participation is as vibrant as it was earlier. And sometimes, you know, when you are faced with this question, the only answer you can give is the previous generation has to really live up to what, and the younger generation is so sharp, they can easily see a difference.
Yes.
If they feel that this person has been a part of this organization and is, you know, revering Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba as divinity, and they believe that Swami is all the time everywhere, so his character or her character reflects that.
Yes.
And I think that's something which is very, because Swami always said practice.
Yes. Absolutely. I think, you know, as they say, children do not do what you say, or children do not learn from what they read or what you speak. They only learn from what they see you do.
Absolutely.
So if they find even a slight variance between what is said and what is actually being practiced by the person who's saying, if they find even a little variance between thought, word and deed, as Swami says, you know, thought, word and deed is not a spiritual life, it is not something spiritual injunction, you know, it is it is absolutely essential in to get credibility even in daily life. As a brother, as a husband, as a person, you know, I think everywhere, because the moment people see hypocrisy at any point, especially I think children, I think the moment they see hypocrisy, then that's when everything falls.
In fact, Swami goes on to say that because of the selfishness, he says, because of the selfishness, all also the hitherto unheard of evil traits in Hindu people are increasing.
Yes.
He says, you know, indecorous behaviors, like they have no regard for fear of sin, love for God, humility, faith and reverence. So fear of sin and love for God, you know, that is something which we see in the news all the time.
Yes.
We see in the news all the time. So, you're having fear of the law. You're having fear of, you know, other things. But fear of sin itself is something which is coming down. That's what's
I think that is because there is some, there is what is called moral vacuity. You know, you can't, I feel very strongly, you can't govern a country only with the laws that are written in the law books.
Absolutely.
You know, how many laws can you really write down? You know, if everything has to be viewed only from what is legal and illegal, there has to be something called moral and immoral. If that moral basis is not there, then, you know, today someone has found one loophole in the law and he is and he is, you know, made good with siphoning of so much of funds from a bank or whatever, and then tomorrow you plug that hole and somebody will open some other other hole. And I think that is why, you know, Gandhiji and Professor Venkatraman always used to quote about Gandhiji saying how, you know, how there is a moral law governing the whole universe.
Absolutely.
And I think that is what was there in India. That, I mean, that is an unspoken, but everyone understands that about the law of truth, about the law of dharma. I mean, no need to put it in words. It was there in the veins of, in the blood of people of India.
I think one place which really stands out in this regard is Japan, because several times we have heard how there is so much of, you know, inbuilt culture in them. Like, for example, when they had that tsunami and when there was that absolute disaster, they said, it was said that drinking water is in shortage and each one can get only one bottle. And there was a journalist who went and he was shocked. He said people were standing in a line, absolutely in perfect discipline, They were collecting their one bottle of water and they were going away. He said, this is unheard of. Where did this come from?
Yes.
And I think sometimes, you know, in even when there were this Chennai floods.
Yes.
And you know, when there is disaster, you see that goodness coming out in people where they're really ready to stretch themselves.
Yes.
And, you know, reach out and help others, help their friends.
I think that is why, you know, Swami says it is there in this land.
It is there in this land,
But we need that environment.
Mm-hmm.
To create that environment, the media, of course, has to help, and the parents have to help. Everyone should work towards the blossoming of what is already there in this land.
Very true. In fact, the Swami brings it all to that one word of selfishness.
Yes.
And he says it's because of selfishness that everything goes in the opposite direction. And Samastha Loka Sukhino Bhavantu, which we chant, I think is a good way of saying that don't limit your concerns to just your family and to your relatives. Expand. Yes. Expansion is love.
In fact, you know, when you mentioned about Samastha Loka Sukhino Bhavantu, once, you know, when boy was chanting this, Swami went to his ear and Swami said, you know, when you chant this, there should be actually tears in your eyes.
I mean,
you should really feel that much.
Oh.
Samastha Loka Sukhino Bhavantu. When you're asking, you know, you're asking for the welfare of all, you should pine for that.
Beautiful.
With that kind of sincerity. You should pine. Swami mentioned to one of the members of the Hyderabad youth.
My God.
So, I mean, that is what is India. You know, you long that everyone should be happy. And that is what is the eternal culture as Sanatana Dharma that Swami is talking about in this. You know, in the next segment, Bhagwan, you know, as we are talking about that moral basis of life, I think that becomes clear. Swami refers to that Rama Rajya. That is what I would think is this Rama Rajya, you know, where
Absolutely.
The moral basis of everything. That is there in the next segment. Probably in the next session, we'll take that segment. So, dear listeners, time is running out. So, we have to draw the curtains on this segment. Please do share your feedback. And if you are reading the Prema Vahini, please do share your insights and thoughts. In fact, we shared one or two instances of whatever occurred to us as we read this, but I'm sure there are so many more thoughts and so many more ideas to understand, elaborate and assimilate what Bhagwan has written. So let us do this endeavor together. So next segment we'll take up, next session we'll take up 17.8 segment. I think with that and one more small segment we'll be done with chapter 17 where Swami is concentrating on Sanatana Dharma. And if you're reading the Telugu Prema Vahini, this is chapter 5. Thank you so much offering this little discussion, this little exchange of thoughts at his lotus feet. A sweet goodbye from Prashant Nilayam. Sairam.